Today on the 21st Show, the campaign to be the next U.S. Senator from Illinois after Dick Durbin's decision not to seek re-election. We'll have the sixth in our series of conversations. Brian Maxwell is an environmental research scientist. He's seeking the Democratic nomination. We'll talk with him about domestic policy, foreign affairs, and politics in an era dominated by President Donald Trump and the MAGA movement. We also want to put your questions to the candidate, so give us a call, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. I'm Brian Mackey with Brian Maxwell for the hour, today on the 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. The race to succeed Dick Durbin as U.S. Senator for Illinois continues, and today we bring you the latest in our series of conversations with candidates in the primaries. There are 16 people running, Democrats and Republicans, and we have scheduled or already done interviews with 13 of them. Another doesn't seem to be doing media, one had a death in the family, we hope to reschedule, and the last, Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy, who is reportedly in Urbana today, please check your email, we'd like to talk. Brian Maxwell is one of the 10 people hoping to represent the Democratic Party in this fall's election. He's an environmental research scientist at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, making him one of the few candidates in the race not based in Chicagoland. Maxwell was raised in Charlotte, North Carolina, and he earned a doctorate in agricultural engineering from North Carolina State University. Postdoctoral work took him to Champaign-Urbana in 2020, where he's resided ever since. Today, he's an assistant research scientist and project engineer with the Illinois Sustainable Technology Center. Maxwell has also been involved in political volunteer work, supporting progressives running for local office and anti-war causes. Now he's running as a first-time candidate in the Senate race. He joins me today from our studios in Urbana. Brian Maxwell, welcome to the 21st Show.
Hey, Brian. Thank you very much for having me. Really appreciate taking the time to give all the candidates in this race a voice. I think that's really important in this particular moment where people are looking for new voices from the Democratic Party. I think that's really important to be for voters to be able to hear from a wide range of candidates and backgrounds.
All right. And we want to hear from voters. We have a lot of ground to cover, as we will today, as we do in these conversations. We're aiming to talk about your background, foreign affairs, domestic policy, and some big picture themes in American government and politics. I also, again, want to hear from you. You can join the conversation throughout the hour. 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. All right, let's start with your background. What was it like for you growing up in North Carolina?
So, yeah, I grew up in rural communities in South Carolina and North Carolina. I grew up in Charlotte. I was raised by my parents and grandmother, who I would credit with, you know, a really great upbringing, which I'm very blessed to have. And really, I credit them with giving me a deep love for the environment and the natural world, which really, you know, pushed me to pursue a career in environmentalism and environmental engineering. And really just a deep empathy and appreciation for wanting to help people in our communities, especially those whose voices often go unheard. So that's been really driven a lot of the work I've done in my life, especially with volunteering related to housing issues. You know, since moving to Urbana, I've worked with a variety of different volunteer organizations for helping the unhoused in our communities, whether it was the Phoenix Center before it was Strides, the Canteen Run, which goes around town delivering coats and food for people that are in need of our communities. That's just been a big part of my life. I grew up in rural communities. This is why I, you know, really understand how a lot of rural communities in this country have felt left behind by the resources and the economy in much of this country. In particular, you know, rural healthcare is definitely an issue and something that I talk about in this campaign. You know, growing up, I almost lost my brother to an allergic reaction. Growing up in rural South Carolina, we lived in a pretty small town where the closest doctor living to us was operating out of a single wide trailer, and he had an allergic reaction to an ant bite. We tried to get him to a to that doctor, didn't have an EpiPen while he was going into anaphylactic shock, and almost lost his life because there wasn't nearby healthcare adequate resources. So I think rural communities definitely need some more attention and investment around this country. And as one of the downstate candidates on this ballot, one of the only downstate candidates on this ballot, I think downstate communities really want a better representation in Congress.
We'll get to that. Tell me about agricultural engineering. What draws you to that as a field?
Yeah, for sure. So agriculture plays a huge part in our natural world. That is one of the biggest land uses in this country. It is a huge part of the economy. There are, what got me into that, there's a huge role for environmentalism to play in the agricultural economy, particularly with respect to more sustainable agriculture. I think that our federal policy, particularly as it relates to the Farm Bill, could use a lot of helpful rewrites to help promote more sustainable agriculture in this country. Right now, we mostly only give federal subsidies to a pretty small number of commodity crops rather than promoting more diversified agriculture in our country that would not only lead to more economically sustainable markets, but more environmentally sustainable markets. And this is crucial for farmers because this is really, farmers are really at the root of our society. They're literally producing the food that's at the base of our society. And I think we need better agricultural policy to support them.
Unintended, it sounds like. All right, so the you're running for Senate. The word Senate, the Latin root is Senex. It literally means old man.
I didn't even know that. Thank you for tidbit of information today.
Why are you aiming for the U.S. Senate on your first campaign? Why not school board or even state Senate? You're 37 years old.
True.
Not an old man.
And those are all options in the future. Should this campaign not succeed? I got into this race in this moment because of what I saw as a lack of leadership at the national level for the Democratic Party and a complete political and moral failure during the 2024 election. And I thought that I think we need new leadership at the federal level. And I think we need hard conversations in our Democratic primaries because we did not have those hard conversations in the 2024 election. And we're living with the consequences of that. I saw the party lose not once, but twice to one of the most unqualified, morally corrupt people to ever hold the White House, not once, but twice. And I had hoped after that second loss, there would be some level of introspection, some level of hard lessons learned by the party. And I have not seen that happen at all. And the clearest example of that being the case is that on some of the party's most unpopular policies, it is the establishment of the Democratic Party is choosing to double down and rather than listen to their voters who have been marching in the streets for years now and choose not to listen to their voters. And I think we need to be doing that. And the federal leadership of this party is not doing that.
Well, you said a political and moral failure. The political failure is self-evident, right?
Yeah.
Trump won the election. What is the moral failure in your view?
In my view, the moral failure of the Democratic Party was the fact that it, leading up to what many of us consider to be one of the most consequential elections of our lifetime, which we are living with the effects of now, the Trump administration, all the violence and chaos that's ensuing from that. In the lead up to that election, the Democratic Party chose not to listen to millions of their own voters who were literally in the streets, setting up encampments across the universities on campuses across the country, asking it, demanding that the party stop sending military support to Israel to commit a genocide in Gaza. It was incredibly unpopular, deeply immoral. We were seeing just catastrophic, unimaginable levels of violence overseas against Palestinians. You had millions of people out in the streets, an entire uncommitted organized campaign, uncommitted vote in the primaries, and the leadership of the Biden-Harris administration did not budge on this issue, not one bit. And to me, I see that as a moral failure of refusing to listen to voters who are trying to go through the correct means of, having their voices heard, protesting, going through the democratic process, and that was completely not heard. And I think that was a really clear missed opportunity by the Democratic Party. And the establishment is still doubling down on these policies. We are still continuing to send military aid to Israel. Two of the leading candidates in this race, the Lieutenant Governor and Congressman Krishnamoorthy, have explicitly said in interviews that if elected to the Senate, they would continue this policy. And, you know, I talked to young voters on this campus, and it is one of the most frequently brought up single issues I hear from young voters. And it's no surprise that the Democratic Party did performed one of the worst in this last election cycle in 2024, performed the worst with young voters than it has in the last, I think, 20 to 30 years.
So this is something I've been asking all the candidates, at least all the Democratic candidates.
Yep.
And just to be clear, I think I heard you say this, but you do believe Israel's response to the attack from Hamas, Israel's response in Gaza constitutes a genocide.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's just not just my opinion. That's the consensus of almost every major international human rights organization.
What should the United States do about that? What are our moral obligations, if you believe that's
our,
the case?
Our moral obligations are to stop sending military aid to Israel. That is a clear, it is a clear violation of the Leahy Act, which says that the U.S. should not send weapons to countries that are using them for war crimes. And there's more than abundant evidence that that has been the case. That is consistent with the Geneva Conventions, which says that countries should take material steps to put an end to supporting a genocide. And I think Americans really need to understand, I think a lot of Americans do, but we need to understand that this is not just something that we are just letting happen. It's not simply that we're failing to intervene. It is that we are directly contributing to this conflict. We are the primary arms dealer for Israel, and that needs to be understood by Americans. And a lot of Americans are tired of this, and it's part of the reason why I got into this race, part of why one of my key platform points is anti-war. Americans on both sides of the aisle, Republicans, Independents, Democrats, are tired of seeing their federal tax dollars be sent overseas for unimaginable levels of violence, instead of really key, necessary investments in our communities that are deeply struggling right now.
If you were in the United States Senate, what sort of response from Israel to what happened in October 2023, what sort of response would you have supported?
That's a great question. A more proportionate response. You know, I see October 7th as the result of decades of failure of diplomatic pressure by the international community, including the United States, to find a peaceful and diplomatic solution to creating two states for both Palestinians and Israelis, and to respect international human rights for both groups of people.
Should America recognize a Palestinian state?
Yes, absolutely. I don't see. I mean, really, that needs to be left up to Palestinians. Palestinians need to be at the negotiating table. Right now, we're seeing the Trump administration forming this Gaza Board of Peace, you know, of who's going to manage Gaza after this has all been said and done. And there are no Palestinians.
It's not clear if there'll be room for Palestinians in Gaza under this plan. Yeah,
no, none at all. And this is important to Illinois. You know, Illinois has the highest Muslim per capita, Muslim per capita population in the country. We have the largest Palestinian American community in the country, and their voices are not being heard at all. And that's why we're seeing a lot of challengers to incumbents in this election cycle, with Dylan Blaha challenging Nikki Budzinski in this district, Joey Ruzovich challenging Sean Kasten up in the 6th district. We're seeing a lot of people step up who want to advocate for a more humane foreign policy.
Do you think that you mentioned that the Democrats lost voters on this issue? Do you think that the voters were right in that? Was that a proper assessment of the lay of the land? Or I guess in another way of saying that is, are Palestinians better off today than they would have been under a President Harris?
I don't know how appropriate that question is, because it was the Biden-Harris administration that collectively helped Israel drop the equivalent of 6 nuclear bombs on Palestine. So whether or not they'd be better off under the Trump administration or the Harris administration, it's hard to say, because we watched the Biden-Harris administration collectively destroy most of the infrastructure of Gaza. So I don't see it as them as being better or worse off, and that's was probably the consensus of much of the community who chose to withhold their votes in that election cycle.
Well, as Kang and Kodo say on The Simpsons, it's a two-party system, for better and worse.
right.
Just a couple of minutes until we need to take a break. Maybe we can hit a couple of other foreign policy topics. Should America seek to conquer Greenland or acquire Greenland?
No. And generally, I think we need to stop with this policy of regime change, military intervention, economic sanctions around the world. I don't know.
Sanctions. So would you support removing sanctions from, you know, Iran, North Korea, for example?
Yes. Economic sanctions, and this is a very misunderstood aspect of foreign policy, how deeply damaging economic sanctions are to countries around the world. The Lancet previously published a study earlier last year saying that U.S. unilateral sanctions, economic sanctions, are roughly responsible for about 500,000 premature deaths every year for the last 50 years on average, 500,000 premature deaths. U.S. economic sanctions, because much of the global financial market system is backed by U.S.-backed institutions, by the U.S. dollar, U.S. sanctions effectively cut off resources for that country to international trade. It makes it harder for people in those countries to access food, fuel, resources. You know, some of the largest migrant outflows around the world have been from countries that have been under U.S.-backed sanctions for 20 to 30 years. We've seen Venezuela be under sanctions for the last 30 years. We've seen Iran be under sanctions for something roughly 20 to 30 years. We've seen Cuba be under sanctions for over 50 years. U.S. sanctions are one of the most damaging foreign policy things that we do around the world, and they're one that least understood by people in this country. They're seen as a form of soft power, soft influence, when in fact is extremely damaging. It is basically siege warfare.
All right. We are talking with Brian Maxwell, one of the 10 Democrats seeking their party's nomination for the United States Senate for the seat that is being vacated by U.S. Senator Dick Durbin at the end of his term, January 2027. Of course, the primary is a lot sooner than that. It's coming up in March. Early voting begins next month in February. If you want to join us, 800-222-9455. This is The 21st Show. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. My guest for the hour today is Brian Maxwell. Very alliterative show. One of the people running in the Democratic primary for the United States Senate in Illinois this year. One of the 10 Democrats running. He is also an agriculture engineer and works with the Illinois Sustainable Technology Center at the U of I in Urbana-Champaign, where he has resided since 2020. 800-222-9455 if you want to join us on the program today. 800-222-9455. I want to stay with foreign policy a little longer because I think this is probably one of the areas where you have the most disagreements with some of the other candidates in this race. Does the U.S. have an interest in a free Ukraine?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there's no question that the people of Ukraine have suffered immensely under the Russian invasion, and we need to... There needs to be a norm around the world of respecting international law and respecting borders. And we absolutely need to be supporting the people of Ukraine in fighting for their independence and fighting for independence movements around the world. People should be able to live in peace and prosperity in their own countries. And part of what I would like to add to that is that I think the United States, if we want other countries to respect international law, we ourselves need to respect international law when we're going in and doing things like illegal invasions of Iraq, illegal kidnappings of the leader of a state in Venezuela, regime change in Libya. If we want other countries to respect international law, respect borders, and respect humanitarian rights, I think the U.S. needs to start leading by example, and it hasn't for most of the last 40 years.
Well, how about Venezuela as an example then? Because there are those who will argue the leader was a bad guy. He seems to have stolen the last election from the opposition party, which won the leader of which won the Nobel Peace Prize, although she was personally not permitted to run. Why not support the toppling of a guy who caused a lot of pain and suffering in Venezuela over the last decade?
the United States works with bad people all around the world, and including in Saudi Arabia and the UAE. The U.S. did not topple the Venezuelan government or remove the leader because he's a bad guy. They removed the leader of Venezuela because the Venezuela government's been opposing the U.S. government's interests in the region for decades. If the U.S. wanted to cared about the welfare of the people of Venezuela, it would have ended the U.S. sanctions on Venezuela over 30 years ago, which have been causing economic pain for 30 years. And we need to understand the one aspect of economic sanctions is it generally makes governments become more authoritarian around the world. Economic sanctions and regime change generally make governments around the world act more authoritarian. We can see how this played out in the U.S. back in 2001 when the U.S. Was the target of one of the worst attacks in our country's history on 9/11 from an outside from foreign interests. One of the worst attacks in our country's history. We saw after that the U.S. become display a lot of authoritarian tendencies. We saw a lot of loss of rights. We saw us engage in warfare all around the world. Resort to the use of torture in many cases, and this was just how we responded to one day of attacks on our country. When we go around the world and attack other countries, sanction them, threaten to remove them from power, those governments generally tend to become more authoritarian, and the U.S. needs to understand its role in promoting that tendency. So this is one of the many aspects of foreign policy, and I appreciate you let me take some time to talk about foreign policy because I don't think enough Americans understand the connection of foreign policy to domestic issues. I'll just give a few quick examples. The main one, over half of our federal spending goes towards military spending. Over half of our federal income tax money and discretionary spending goes towards military spending and primarily the Pentagon, an agency that hasn't passed an audit in over 10 years. And those have real impacts in our communities. That means that that money is not spent on housing systems, that is not spent on food and housing assistance and healthcare. That has real consequences for our communities. So that's just federal spending. With respect to climate change.
And just to be clear, discretionary spending. Just discretionary to emphasize that point. This is not counting Social Security, yes. Medicare, Medicaid. Okay.
Yes. Yep. Over half of discretionary spending. We talk about climate change. I'm an environmental researcher. I've studied climate science most of my life. The U.S. military is the largest institutional source of greenhouse gas emissions on the planet. That is a fact. The only institutions that have larger emissions than the U.S. military are entire countries. I find that there is very little hope of us of adequately addressing climate change if we are not investing enough resources and our best and brightest minds into addressing climate change. We are seeing a global rise in military spending, a global rise in militarism that is taking us further and further away from the kind of international collaboration and cooperation that we're going to need to address this global issue is taking us further and further away from it. And on my last point, I'll talk about immigration. Like I talked about U.S. sanctions before, regime change. U.S. regime change, economic sanctions, illegal invasions are one of the primary drivers of mass migration around the world. It is estimated that the war on terror displaced some 35 million people over the years. 35 million people were displaced by the U.S. war on terror. And that's not just in the Middle East, that's in Africa, where under the Obama administration, we essentially turned Libya from one of the most prosperous countries in Africa into a failed state, sent hundreds of thousands of people fleeing the country, many of them across the Mediterranean and to Europe. We've seen how decades of regime change and economic sanctions have uprooted people from their communities all across Central and South America. And it is a root driver of mass migration around the world. And it has, in many ways, led to the rise of the far right around the world, who have, really weaponized immigration and sought to, advance their own causes on it and use it to, in my mind, promote a pretty harmful and racist platform as far as, dehumanizing immigrants, which is what we're seeing the fallout of today under the Trump administration.
I guess maybe to wrap up this portion of the conversation, America has been a global superpower for all of my lifetime, all of your lifetime, the lifetime of most of our listeners. Should America seek to continue to be a global superpower, or do you think we should give that up?
I don't think that it is in America's best interest, American citizens' best interest, to try and maintain ourselves as a global superpower. As we've seen military spending go up, we've seen material conditions in this country worsen. I don't think that we can have $1 trillion a year military budget and adequately take care of people in this country, because we are not. I think that we need to find diplomatic ways to achieve consensus around the world. And it is a far more economic, a far cheaper solution to disagreements around the world. You know, I think that if our government wants us to, you know, see this rise in political violence around the world, I think if our government wants to slow that trend or end that trend, essentially, it needs to be leading by example and be pursuing diplomacy and peaceful resolutions to these disagreements with governments around the world, not military intervention, and not trying to, you know, play this role of a global hegemon around the world.
If you're just joining us, it's the 21st show. We're speaking with Brian Maxwell. He is one of the candidates for United States Senate, running on the Democratic Party primary coming up in March. 800-222-9455 if you want to join us today. And let's go now to the phones. John is calling from Rockford. John, thank you for calling in.
Oh, well, thanks for taking me, Brian. Mr. Maxwell, I'm very delighted to hear of your position on military aid to Israel. I wanted to let you know, perhaps you know about this, that back in about 1975, the Glenn and Symington Amendments to the Act that allows the U.S. government to provide foreign aid to foreign countries absolutely prohibited all foreign aid to countries that have nuclear weapons and have not signed the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. Israel has nukes and has not signed that treaty. Therefore, every dollar of aid to Israel since 1975 has been illegal. That's for your consideration if you want to think about it. One other thing I wanted to mention about your opponent, the front runner, Mr. Krishnamurti. Mr. Krishnamurti has a religion. It's Hinduism. He's a minority. That's a minority in this country. And I'm a socialist, and that is my religion, and that's a minority in this country. But on the 2nd of February in 2023, Mr. Krishnamurti voted for H. Con Res 9, denouncing the horrors of socialism. And in that resolution, Congress outright denounces socialism in all its form and opposes implementation of socialistic policies. Now, how can a man who practices a minority religion freely vote for this resolution that attacks my minority religion? You might be interested to know that of the entire House of Representatives, 328 members, 219 Republicans and 109 Democrats voted for this resolution in violation of the oath of office, as clearly I can see. So maybe you can ask him sometime, since I haven't been able to, even though I've written him a couple of times, to please explain why he thinks he can denounce my religion.
And John, thank you so much for the call. We appreciate it. Brian, let me ask you about, do you identify as a socialist or a democratic socialist, or how do you characterize yourself?
Yeah, I would say I support socialist policies. I think the identification of isms and ists gets really lost in the weeds, and people put too much identity behind a label. But I do support socialist policies because we see them succeed all across Europe. And we have many socialist policies here in the U.S. with respect to even some healthcare policies, how we, essentially subsidize public roads in this country. That is a mass public benefit that, benefits society that we all chip in to contribute to. And I do think it is says a lot about the Democratic Party that they chose to vote on this resolution when you're seeing socialist policies become more and more popular with people in this country because they are not seeing our current economic system working for most people in this country. The current system of primarily, predatory capitalism and dog-eat-dog capitalism, we're not seeing that work for most people in this country. The status quo has not worked for the working class in this country for decades. We've seen more and more of our country's wealth and the value and wealth produced by the working class primarily ends up in the hands of a smaller and smaller number of people. So, I totally agree with the caller, and thank you for calling in and saying that. I haven't spoken with Raja Krishnamurthy personally. In a lot of these forums, they've done a pretty good job of keeping us separated from the top candidates, because I don't think they want us to ask hard questions of them. Absolutely. I think we need more policies in this country that actually benefit the working class and not a small number of individuals and corporations in this country.
We don't have time to get into a sort of college debate about the definition of the word socialism.
I will
say, stay tuned. We're going to talk about this in depth in the coming months on an upcoming program. But I do think it's one of those terms where you say it and some people think free healthcare, free college, and other people think of gulags and breadlines. And so you really do need to define your terms. Let's move on to domestic policy, though. Should we abolish ICE?
I am for essentially abolishing ICE. Yeah, I think what we've allowed Immigration Customs Enforcement to become in this country has gotten completely out of hand. We are seeing it become essentially a paramilitary police force ran by the federal government whose authority supersedes state governments. And we are seeing everyday citizens, people with documentation in this country, having their rights violated. We are seeing extrajudicial assassinations of citizens in the streets. And all this took Trump less than 6 months to do. It took Trump less than 6 months to turn this agency into one of the most well-funded paramilitary forces in the country. The annual budget now for ICE is larger than most countries' militaries around the world. And for most of its inception, the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, is less than 30 years old. For most of its inception, it has been used as a tool for racially profiling communities in this country. It was used to racially profile Muslim Americans after 9/11. It has been used to racially profile immigrant communities, and it's continuing to do that. I think that leaving that infrastructure in place for the next time someone like Trump comes along is extremely dangerous. I think we can do better than this kind of violent treatment, carceral treatment of our immigrant communities in this country.
You mentioned political and moral failures of the Biden-Harris administration. Did they do or not do the right thing in not having more restrictive border enforcement, if that makes sense, how I phrase that?
They had, the Biden administration, its deportation numbers were higher than the Trump administration. I don't think that they were as lax as people
say. I'm talking about people coming over the border, right? Because those are the images that so captured the nation's attention. And is what a lot of voters say that they really didn't appreciate about Biden.
We have to have border enforcement for sure. But when people are coming to our borders with legitimate asylum claims, as many people do, that is a part of international law. We need to be respecting asylum claims in this country. And I think we need a holistic reform to our immigration policy that doesn't include just a pathway to citizenship for many of the people that have been in this country for decades and are contributing members of society, not just that, but a holistic overview, a holistic change to our immigration policy that includes how we approach foreign policy, how we handle these interventions and economic sanctions on other countries that are often a driver of people into this country.
All right. We are talking with Brian Maxwell. He is an agricultural engineer currently based at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He works at the Illinois Sustainable Technology Center there. He's also been involved in political volunteer work, supporting progressives, running for local offices and anti-war causes. And he is a first-time candidate in the race, the Democratic primary race for the United States Senate, for the office being vacated by U.S. Senator Dick Durbin at the end of his term in January 2027. 800-222-9455. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455. I should also say, just a little forward promotion coming up on the program tomorrow, we'll be interviewing a candidate for governor. Ted Dabrowski is a former banker and sort of policy think tank guy here in Illinois. He's running for the Republican nomination. If you have questions for him, talk@21stshow.org is our email address. Talk@21stshow.org. www.senatecandidate.org. That's coming up tomorrow on the program. But we will have more with Senate candidate Brian Maxwell when we return. This is The 21st Show. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking with Brian Maxwell, candidate for United States Senate in the Democratic primary, one of 10 candidates. That election is coming up in March. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455. I should say we're speaking with 13 of the 16 overall candidates. We've either done so or are scheduled to do so. You can find a link to hear others in our series of conversations at our website, 21stshow.org. All right, Brian, we have less than 15 minutes left. We could spend an hour on each of these topics, but we're not going to. So let's do some kind of quick, maybe, you know, sort of quicker hits on some of the domestic policy topics that are of interest to many voters. Do you own a personal firearm?
I don't personally own a firearm, but I respect citizens' rights to own a firearm. I think that needs to be done responsibly and with adequate training and enforcement.
What do you say to the voters who think Democrats in general and, you know, the present administration in Illinois in particular are out to get them?
I don't believe that to be the case, but I do think that I think that citizens need to effectively be responsible for how they I guess, exercise their Second Amendment rights. We all live in the same society. We have to live with the consequences of us having one of the worst gun cultures in the world. It's just a fact that we have some of the highest rates of gun violence in the world. And that comes with a responsibility. Having the Second Amendment comes with some responsibilities to own that firearm responsibly. Sorry, I keep saying the word responsibly a lot. But I think this needs to be adequately enforced.
Abortion is obviously another issue on a lot of people's minds. When do you think life begins?
Wow, that is more of a metaphysical question than. Regardless of when life begins, I believe that women deserve the right to exercise control over their own bodies, and that's really what I think a lot of the debate about abortion rights is. Not allowing women the right to exercise rights over their own bodies. We have some of the highest rates.
I hear that. I'm going to gently push back on that because I know there are, you know, people out there of good conscience, you know, who truly believe that abortion is murder. And I think they would take issue with the idea that, you know, this is only about controlling women as chattel, which I know is also a widespread view among people. So that's why I asked the question as, you know, because this is it, right? If life begins, you know, at the quickening or 6 weeks or 12 weeks or
I don't believe that life begins at conception. And I don't believe that women choosing to have an abortion is murder.
Another issue that the Trump administration and Republicans generally have put front and center are protections for transgender people, transgender health care, everything from expelling people who are trans from the military, changing passport opportunities for gender markers. Where are you on this issue? What do you think of how the administration has been proceeding, and what would you do about it in the Senate?
I think that we need to be protecting some of our most vulnerable communities, and the LGBTQ community, including the trans community, has some of the highest rates are the targets of some of the highest rates of violence, some of the highest rates of mental health issues, suicide, and I think these communities need to be supported. They need to feel supported. My brother's in the LGBTQ community. He spent much of his life having to deal with the kind of violence and oppression that is targeted towards the LGBTQ community. And I think they need to be supported through real meaningful civil rights legislation.
All right, let's go back to the phones, 800-222-9455. We have Doug calling from Naperville. Doug, thanks for calling in.
Thank you, Brian. Good morning. I would have first briefly thank you, Mr. Maxwell, for entering into public life, into this race. Very touched by your words about your grandmother and your parents and your South Carolina, North Carolina roots. My question, which you really welcome and need your help, is the great questioning for Democrats. Our elections, one in the center or one on the left, and this appeal to you, the tradition of Adlai Stevenson, father and son of Paul Douglas, Paul Simon, Dick Durbin, that elections, I believe, as being of now the 80 years old, open to those who feel very differently, younger, particularly Democrats, but continue to believe that elections are won in the center rather than on the left. Ezra Klein, David Brooks, I think others continually make that argument, and I just appeal to you, or want to listen to your thoughts. Would you see that the elections would be won in the center more than on the left? All respect for Bernie Sanders and many others, and for you, just ask your thoughts on where are elections won, in the center or on the left for Democrats.
Thanks for the call, Doug. Appreciate it.
That's a great question. I think that where do I believe that there's more promise for economic policies that actually respond to the material needs of people in this country? And I think that's some of the policies that are being put forward by people on the left. We are seeing, in my mind, the rise of Trumpism and the MAGA movement is born out of a lot of the economic insecurity of people in this country. The status quo has not been working for people in this country. For decades, we've seen the material conditions of the working class decline for the last 50, 60 years. And I don't see a lot of meaningful policy proposals come out of the center that address those material conditions. I don't think that we can improve the conditions of the working class, and I don't think we can counter the status quo and counter the, you know, this populist uprising, this populism of the MAGA movement, while pushing status quo centrist economic policies. If you look at the popularity of, you know, Mayor Mamdani, the new mayor of New York, a lot of his policies were, I would consider, more left-leaning economic policies of trying to make life more affordable for people in New York City. So I support compromise where possible. But I do believe that some of the more meaningful economic policies that address the status quo in this country are coming from the left.
Well, how do you reckon then that people like Joe Biden, who was pretty centrist in 2020, were, you know, he got more votes than Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primary?
I would argue Biden actually. So I've volunteered on the Biden campaign. I worked on that campaign. And I would argue that his platform was pretty progressive. It appealed to a really broad coalition. It appealed to Muslim American voters, the Black community, Latino community, young voters, LGBTQ rights. He, you know, ran on policing reform. He ran on the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. He ran on reparations to Black farmers who have had their, you know, suffered from de facto land theft policy by the USDA for decades. He ran on a lot of progressive causes that really inspired a lot of young voters and inspired a really broad coalition. And that is what I think is the key to actually beating back Trumpism and the MAGA movement, is building a broad coalition. And in my mind, that broad coalition was shattered in the 2024 election. Young voters, progressive voters, Muslim American voters, who were pretty appalled by the administration's unwillingness to meet their demands with respect to foreign policy. So I actually feel that the Biden administration, he himself was a centrist, and he ended up not delivering on a lot of those campaign promises. But I would argue that his platform was pretty progressive.
A couple of Senate procedural questions quickly. Again, we're short on time. If you were elected, Sam in Springfield asks, would you vote for a new Democratic leader to replace Chuck Schumer?
I would. I don't think his leadership is leading the party in the direction that it needs to be to win elections. And I think that under his leadership, we've seen him continually back unpopular candidates or establishment candidates. And he in particular is largely responsible for doubling down on this policy of supporting continued military support for Israel.
What do you think about the filibuster?
I 100% support ending the filibuster, and I'll tell you why. We are not getting 60 votes in the Senate anytime soon. Any meaningful legislation that's going to fundamentally improve the material conditions of the working class in this country is not going to pass the Senate with 60 votes, because we're not getting it. And the filibuster has largely turned Congress into a dysfunctional body. It can't get anything major passed. I would argue, like, the last meaningful legislation we really passed was the ACA over 20 years ago. And, you know, it's essentially deferred most civil rights decisions and most budgeting and funding decisions to the executive branch, to the White House and the Supreme Court. And we've seen what the Supreme Court's been doing with civil rights over the last few years. If we don't end the filibuster, we are not going to pass any meaningful climate legislation. We're not going to pass any meaningful civil rights legislation like the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. We are not going to, I don't see a pathway to passing Medicare for All, which I support. I don't see us passing Medicare for All when we couldn't even pass a increase to the federal minimum wage through the budget reconciliation process, which only requires a simple majority. If we can't even do that through the budget reconciliation, we're not going to pass one of the largest healthcare revisions in this country through that process. So I 100% support ending the filibuster.
Just ACA, you meant, threw that out there for listeners. It's yes. Affordable Care Act, March of 2010, that was signed into law. Yeah. So we're coming to the end of our time together. You've touched on this in a number of different ways, but put yourself in the mind of the young male voter, especially, right, who voted for President Trump in 2024. What was that person not hearing from Vice President Harris and the Democrats?
I think that for much of that movement, I would probably, part of it is the argument of economic insecurities, I think, are still not being addressed by either party in this country. We keep hearing promises by both parties that they end up not delivering on. But what a lot of the young male voter movement heard from at least Trump saying, he's not delivered on this at all, and like most things, he's lied about it, but was that he wanted to focus on people in this country rather than getting us untangled in another war, getting us, you know, sending more money overseas and starting up another war, and investing in communities here at home. And a lot of people want to see that. A lot of people in this country want to see us stop getting entangled in foreign wars and start investing our federal tax dollars here in our communities at home on things like housing, on healthcare, on education, on reparations that are long overdue. People want to see our federal tax dollars invested in communities here at home rather than constantly being sent overseas.
Last question. Dick Durbin resides in Springfield. What difference do you think it makes for Illinois to have someone from outside Chicago representing the state in the Senate?
I think that it helps having a downstate representative in the Senate who is more connected with and lives in downstate communities, particularly someone who has experience working in rural communities, has grown up in rural communities, has experience with working with farmers. We've seen...
If I can just turn it around, though, because I've asked candidates from Chicago how they relate to people in, you know, rural Illinois, southern Illinois. You would need to win voters in Chicago to win this statewide
race. Yeah, absolutely.
How do you relate to them?
Yeah, I'm meeting people in Chicago as well. I inspired a lot of voters in Chicago with my message about reinvesting our tax dollars here at home. That's a rural and an urban thing that people want to see in this country. But, you know, we see this, you know, kind of geographical divide in this state. I think, you know, I don't remember the last count, but many counties downstate want to secede from the state because they don't feel like their voices are being adequately heard. And I don't think that farmers and rural communities' voices are being heard in our federal leadership. Farmers are in a mental health crisis right now. Farmers have some of the highest rates of suicide in this country, and that's a public health crisis, and that's a national security crisis in my mind. And we need to be, you know, doing investments in rural health care, access to virtual mental health services, and we need to be helping build more reliable agricultural economies, which we are not doing. And the Trump administration has played a large part in totally upending international trade markets through his kind of reckless unilateral tariffs.
We will have to leave for another day the debate that I would love to have about whether farmers are over or underrepresented in Congress. Oh, Brian Maxwell
absolutely.
Is a
That's a great point. It's a great point. Yeah, you're very true.
Brian Maxwell is a candidate for United States Senate. He's running in the Democratic primary. The election is coming up in March. Early voting begins in different times in different places in Illinois, so I'm not going to give a date, but in February, check your local listings. Brian, thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We will talk with you again tomorrow.